This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 34. Welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the USA Firearm Training Network, and I am your host, Riley Bowman.
Riley, the man who wishes his golf game was as good as his shooting game. And I am Brandon Scott.
Brandon is the guy who carries an AR-15 everywhere he goes.
It's true.
I hope you're not breaking like any laws you don't know about.
In fact, if you stay tuned for my pick of the week, I'll tell you how I do it without freaking people out and being in the news.
Nice. Today's topic is the myths surrounding assault rifles. With the recent terrorist attacks in San Bernardino, Orlando, and even Dallas, there is much attention being given to so-called assault rifles. Is all this talk warranted? Just what are assault rifles and weapons anyway? What is the definition of assault weapon? Does it make sense to issue new gun control edicts restricting the purchase and possession of these or similar firearms? Will it stop another Orlando from occurring? Brandon, a true AR-15 fanatic, and I, a wannabe AR-15 fanatic, discuss this and more on the Concealed Carry Podcast. But first, today's episode is brought to you by the Taft Precision AR-15 Lower Parts Kit, and Brandon has a special message to introduce that later on in the episode. But before we forget, staying true to our recent pattern of doing things, we wanted to talk about a couple of special events that occurred on this day in history. Today being that we're recording this on July 12th, 2016, actually to be released on July 13th. And I looked at the two dates and I thought, you know what? Today's the 12th of July. Events in history I thought were a little more interesting than tomorrow. So anyway, first of all, in 1862 on July 12th, the Medal of Honor was created.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. And so far, I think it's like 3,400, I want to... Well, actually, here it is. Looking, if you follow the links in the show notes, it takes you to the history.com page. More than 3,400 men and women have received the Medal of Honor for heroic actions. It's a wonderful tribute, I think, to those that honestly sacrifice and give so much. And oftentimes, it's awarded posthumously. And you know, where someone has sacrificed and gave all. So on this day in 1862, Medal of Honor created. So also on this day in 1965, the first Marine ever to win the, not the first Marine ever, but the first Marine to win, not to win. That's the History Channel. Oh, get your act together. You don't win the Medal of Honor.
No.
It is not something that you win.
Awarded.
You are awarded. You receive the Medal of Honor. I'm going to write these guys a message and say that's the wrong terminology. They should know better. Anyway, the first Marine to receive the Medal of Honor was Lieutenant Frank Reasoner of Kellogg, Idaho, which is my home state.
There you go. One of your buddies.
Yeah.
You're probably his neighbor.
That's right. That's right. So, and because it's so interesting and compelling, I think, here's the story about what happened. He and a 5-man point team was accompanying they or he was accompanying them. They were cut off from the main body of their company. He ordered his men to lay down a base of fire, and then repeatedly exposing himself to enemy fire, killed 2 Viet Cong, single-handedly wiped out an enemy machine gun emplacement, and raced through enemy fire to rescue his injured radio operator. Trying to rally his men, Reasoner was hit by enemy machine gun fire and was killed instantly. For this action, Reasoner was nominated for America's highest award for valor. And so Navy Secretary Paul H. Nitz presented the Medal of Honor to his widow, to Lieutenant Reasoner's widow and son, in ceremonies at the Pentagon on January 31st, 1967. But his actions took place on July 12th, 1965.
Hmm.
So there you go.
You know, every time I hear a story about why a Medal of Honor was you know, given or received, it just always boggles my mind. Just the courage of these individuals who have received that honor. It's just, I'm so grateful to be a part of this country and to have that legacy, and It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. I had the pleasure probably 6 or 7 years ago to hear a presentation by, and I wish I wasn't prepared to talk about this in the episode today, or I would have looked it up. But he was a Medal of Honor recipient from World War II, and he was actually Japanese American, and he, you know, similar story, you know, just basically ran into enemy fire, and he took out machine guns and, you know, a bunch of enemy soldiers, threw grenades in their foxholes and stuff, you know, and rescued a lot of his men. And he survived, you know. So here he was in person telling us his story and his tale. And I was just like, oh, wow, you know.
Yeah.
He was pretty old at that point. And I think he's still alive. I would guess he's, you know, 95, 96 years old, you know.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So, yep. Wow. Anyway. Good stuff. And then also on this day in history, and this one I had to throw it in because it just makes sense. Wild Bill Hickok's first gunfight, July 12th, 1861. So this is actually where he established his reputation as a gunfighter after he coolly shot three men during a shootout in Nebraska. Nothing exciting happens in Nebraska, three by the way, one. Except for this sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was a skilled marksman, and he practiced a lot to, you know, handle the handgun, the revolver very effectively, and all that practice came through for him. I'm not going to go into the full story. It's really interesting, but because we got a lot of really other cool stuff to go into today, I'm going to leave you to going to the show notes and going to the link and reading it for yourself. So
it really is a pretty intense story.
Yeah, it's cool. Cool stuff. So back to what we're here for today, the myths surrounding assault rifles. Specifically, we're going to talk about at least six myths surrounding the assault rifle. Honestly, it'll probably be a few more than that, but we've identified six major things. And so to kick it off, let me just give a little bit of history behind the AR-15 modern sporting rifle, as we would like to call it. So the design of the AR-15 rifle started out as a design by Eugene Stoner. Eugene Stoner, pretty, you know, famous dude because of the AR-15. He worked at Armalite. And Armalite, you know, still exists today. I think they've gone bankrupt, and you know the company's been resurrected a couple of times, which is really not that unusual in the firearms industry, because I think Colt has done that. You know, but Eugene Stoner worked at Armalite. He was a brilliant designer. He started working in the machine shop for Whitaker, and Whitaker made aircraft equipment, and then he then came over to be chief engineer for Armalite. And so he started designing all these small guns, AR-3, AR-9, AR-11, AR-12, and they just never really took off. Other than he designed one called the AR-5, which was intended as a survival rifle and was adopted by and used by the United States Air Force. It's a little compact rifle that, you know, breaks down really small, and basically like a pilot that got shot down could get his AR-5 survival rifle. And by the way, a successor to that is also known as the AR-7, which is very similar. And so they'd have that survival rifle, which was, you know, a rifle is always a better fighting tool than a handgun. And so that was kind of the idea there. But anyway, he started working on a design known as the AR-10, which was intended to be a selective fire. So that would mean what? It would have a position for safe, position for semi-automatic.
Semi, and either three-round or full auto, right?
Exactly.
Is it three-round that's associated in that as well?
Well, it can be. So, like, there are variations of M16 and M4 rifles, and probably the original intent, the AR-10, you know, may have had... Yeah, there's variations where there's safe, semi-auto, and three-round burst, or safe, semi-auto, and fully auto. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the AR-10 was intended to be a selective fire infantry rifle in the classic 7.62 NATO caliber. That's basically 308 Winchester. His intent was for this to compete against the M14. Okay, this is in the early 1950s. And so, of course, we know the history. M14 was what won out, was used for a number of years. But ironically enough, you know, Stoner got kind of his just dues, if you will, because the AR-10 maybe didn't win that military contract. But later, when Armalite was struggling financially, they sold the rights of the AR-15. And the AR-15, by the way, was a smaller version of the AR-10 designed at, also at Armalite. And they designed it to fit the 223 Remington cartridge, right? And so you had the AR-15, which was also designed to become the M6, or it was also designed to compete for a military contract. And actually, it did eventually succeed in the form of the M16. Now, this is not the first time you take a civilian-style rifle, which that's really what it was at the time.
Or firearm.
Because when even before they got the contract, there was always the intent to sell and market this as civilian. And this was not uncommon back in the day. Many firearms manufacturers would design and make guns, both with the intent of competing for perhaps military contracts if it was open to them, but also take advantage of the civilian market and sell their guns, you know, to the civilian market. And so anyway, the point is Colt ends up with the rights to the AR-15 and also M16 contracts. And so you have the M16, which is a selective fire, meaning it can do semi-auto or fully auto or 3-round automatic burst. And then the AR-15 was also launched to the civilian market. So that's a little bit about kind of the history. It's a brief history of the AR-15, kind of how it got started.
Well, that brings us into our first myth surrounding assault rifles. And, you know, you right. talked about the Armalite. You know, one of the big myths that you hear folks, talk about out there is that AR stands for assault rifle. But what does the AR in AR-15 actually stand for?
Yeah, it's a real clever name, actually. It stands for Armalite rifle. See, clever. You had a company called Armalite that designed and made the rifle, and they're like, let's call it the Armalite rifle, model 15, because Eugene Stoner, creating these AR-3, AR-5, AR-7, AR-10, you know, all these different, like they all start with AR, they were Armalite rifles. This is what they called them, what the designation was in the company. That's all it was, you know, and they just kind of, as they moved through the progression of these various guns and designs, they just tacked on another number. So we got to the 15th iteration of an Armalite rifle, and it was called the AR-15.
Right. And then, like you said, they sold that AR terminology to Colt that still maintains that that branding today. Is that correct?
Yeah. Colt owns the trademark to AR-15. It has become a colloquialized term. So yeah, everybody uses it. But as far as manufacturers go, I think it's only Colt that can stamp on their guns AR-15. And so all other manufacturers use a kind of a variation of it, you know, like, I think Smith & Wesson, you know, uses MP15 or, you know, because the M&P line or something similar to that. I actually had an AR-15 made by Armalite. It's one of my first ARs I ever owned. I want to say it was actually labeled as an M15. I could be wrong on that. That was a number of years ago. You know, then I had one made by Superior Arms, which, by the way, fantastic AR makers out of Iowa, and they labeled theirs an S15. You know, so there's all these, you know, so everyone has to make their own kind of designation, but it almost always ends in 15, and then they put whatever they want in front of it. Mm-hmm. But Colt is the they own the AR-15 name. So the first myth, like you were saying, Brandon, AR-15s, you brought us into that by saying, you know, what does AR actually stand for? And so people think assault rifle, which is not necessarily what that actually stands for. But they still will say AR-15s are, in fact, assault rifles. So this is our first major myth.
Right. Like a lot of people will call them assault weapons or machine guns or military grade weapons, all that kind of, there's all kinds of, you know, stuff, fear tactics that are being used out there to describe right. what these are.
And Brandon, you know what? Look, I think there's something important that we got to do here. We need to actually define what an assault rifle or an assault weapon is.
Perfect.
So if according to definition, go ahead, what is it?
An assault weapon is defined as a rapid-fire, magazine-fed, automatic rifle designed for infantry use. And so there's a couple of key terms in that definition that make the civilian AR-15 as we know it today not classified. You know, it does not meet the definition of an assault weapon. First and foremost, the automatic portion. For your standard AR-15 these days and kind of the variants on AR-15s in the civilian market, they are all semi-automatic. And just to talk a little bit, I know that a lot of my students get confused between what does semi-automatic mean and what does automatic mean. And basically, semi-automatic means you pull the trigger and that pistol or rifle or firearm, shotgun, whatever it is, it will fire and auto load itself once, right? So I squeeze the trigger and hold it down and that firearm will fire and auto load itself once. Full automatic means, or, you know, magazine fed automatic would mean that you pull the trigger and hold it down and it will continue to fire and auto load itself until you either let go of the trigger or you've expended all of your ammunition.
Yeah. Yep. So that is the major key here in the definition, because an AR-15 could be, you could argue that it is that it shoots rapidly. I mean, it's going to fire as fast as you can move your finger, and you've got to move it every time you want it to fire. Mm-hmm. It is magazine.
Well, I can also argue that I can fire even a revolver pistol fairly rapidly. You know, I mean, you get these really talented bolt action guys that can fire bolt actions pretty dang rapidly. And so, you know, it's funny, mm-hmm. just, you know, as you see kind of the scare tactics that a lot of the folks in the media use to just make it sound a lot scarier than it really is. You know, I mean, what does rapid fire actually mean? You know, according to some senators that I've seen some pretty embarrassing YouTube videos of, you know, apparently that means, you know, thousands of rounds in a half a second and these ghost magazine clip things that are just, you know, out of control, shooting millions and millions of rounds in less than an hour. And I mean, you know, this, it just spins out of control so fast.
Right, right. No, I hear what you're saying. Hey, yeah, rapid fire. I guess we'd have to define what exactly do they mean when they say rapid fire? How many rounds per minute or second or whatever? I don't know. But I think it's plausible that you could suggest that an AR-15 is capable of shooting fairly rapidly. Sure. I mean, if you're shooting maximum speed with your finger moving just as fast as you can work the trigger, how many rounds would you say you could shoot in a minute?
Oh, gosh. Am I Jerry Michalek or just me?
Just you.
In a minute? Oh, geez. Yeah. Like, I have no idea.
You didn't have to reload, right?
You know, I could probably do like 3 a second.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. Like three, like maybe at first you could do maybe 4 a second, but like your finger would start to get tired. And, you know, like,
yeah.
Like in reality, I'll bet you could do that. That's what, about 180 rounds a minute. So.
Well, taking it back to effectiveness, because, you know, it's like, am I just squeezing rounds off or am I going as fast as I can while remaining accurate? I would say while remaining accurate, I'm definitely in the 2 to maybe 3 on a good day, kind of a rate.
Yeah. But you're not going to keep that up for a full, like, straight, right? You know, like
heck
it's no. like yeah. you aim and maybe 2-3 shots and then you aim and a couple of shots and,
absolutely.
But I get what you're saying. So, but I mean, best case scenario, you can fire a AR-15 or any semi-automatic weapon with, if you didn't have to reload at all, probably 180 rounds a minute, which compared to, you know, many fully auto actual true assault rifles that the military uses, which probably vary anywhere from 700 to maybe 1,000 rounds per minute. That's a substantial difference. So when we say assault rifle, it is something that's intended for infantry use. That's the other key part of the definition here. And infantry grade, you know, military grade weapons, most of them are capable of full auto fire, and they're going to fire probably on average 800 to 900 rounds per minute. That's a big difference between maybe 150 or 180 rounds a minute, and that's not you having to reload. So in reality, with reloads and everything, I'll bet a really skilled shooter might could fire 90 to 100 rounds per minute. Big difference, big discrepancy. Yeah,
huge difference.
I would argue that when we say rapid fire, we really mean in the 500 or 600 rounds per minute plus range.
I agree.
So an AR-15 is not that, a civilian model in particular. So, absolutely. You know, the term machine guns, what is a machine gun? And is a machine gun different than, you know, like an M16? Because an M16 would be, or an M4, which is the more, I guess, modern variant of an M16. Mm-hmm. They are both select fire. They are capable of firing in that, like I said, 800 to 900, you know, rounds per minute sort of range. Now, granted, even with those, you do have to reload. So you're not going to actually get that many rounds in a minute. Are those different than from, say, a machine gun? And so what is a machine gun, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, I would put the machine gun more in like the minigun, or, you know, like definitely the Browning M2 kind of a category, where, you know, you have in many cases, you know, instead of like just a handheld magazine, you would have like a box of ammunition that's pinned together.
Yeah. Well, how about this? I mean, let me make it real easy on you. How about like an M249, which is officially called, you know, it's referred to as classified as a light machine gun.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah, like so there's the actual term used in the description of the weapon.
Right.
M249 squad automatic weapon, or SAW, light machine gun.
Yeah, that would probably be the smallest thing that I would think of when I think of a machine gun.
Yeah, and it's shooting that five.
Most of the time I think about.
Sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, I was just saying it. Yeah, and it's shooting the same thing as an AR-15 or an M16 or an M4, mm-hmm. but yeah, it's got this big box with all these rounds in it. I think they can hold about what, 300?
Let's see.
I want to say that they hold around 300, maybe 200 or 300 rounds. Okay, in one belt. Okay. And how fast do they fire? Or they fire at like 800 rounds per minute. So
this says the sustained rate of fire is about 100 rounds per minute. The rapid rate of fire is 200 rounds per minute. And then the cyclic rate of fire. So it has the ability to fire at 800.
Well, and see, by sustained, what they mean is like that's the realistic.
Yeah.
You know, like, because if you just went 800 rounds per minute, like nonstop all the time, you'd burn it up.
Yeah, it'd
be expensive. Fall apart. You know, like you can't sustain that. So they say sustained, you know, rate of fire would be realistically like 100 rounds per minute. Like you're running off like 5 or 10 rounds, you know, per time. Like, you know, mm-hmm. and you're taking a break. Like you know, there's little pauses in between because you're not going to just be going full on out. You know, because you're just going to burn up the gun.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right. That's kind of So here we've kind of classified, you know, machine guns, which are like a whole different beast. And these are weapons that civilians just don't really get their hands on.
I mean, the biggest thing when you're talking, you know, when you're talking with your friends about, you know, when you're trying to tell your friends who doesn't understand anything about firearms and AR-15s and what, you know, assault weapons and all that kind of stuff, the biggest thing is the automatic portion, right? Fully automatic versus semi-auto.
Yep. So, I mean, machine gun, which is, like I said, a whole different animal than like a M16, M4, which is still fully auto, and it is an assault rifle. It shoots very rapidly. It's fully auto. But then we got AR-15, and it's not, I mean, yes, it's kind of like the M16, M4. It's certainly nothing like an M249.
Yeah.
Right?
But I mean, it's like it in that it looks like it and has similar mm-hmm. parts. But the key functionality that makes an M16, you know, viable for the battlefield or preferable in the battlefield is what the AR-15 is missing.
Yep. You did say something earlier that I think was critical. And you said that, you know, you aiming your shots, like that's a totally different rate of fire than just, you know, running shots off, you know, with, you know, willy nilly.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so an AR-15 is semi-auto, and you're going to probably, you know, be more inclined to aim your shots, which is always going to be more effective. Really, fully automatic fire is intended for like needing to control areas and zones on a battlefield where you're laying down just heavy, heavy fire, suppression fire, trying to, control zones and, you know, maybe buy time for, you know, troops to move to a certain location, to keep enemies from, you know, being so inclined to fire at you, you know, things like that. AR-15 is really something that's intended for precise single shots.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting about, you know, the role of full automatic fire on the battlefield is, of course, you know, like you talked about with controlling zones and helping troops to move and you know, controlling the pace and position of the enemy in some cases. But like the big thing too, like you look at the history of black powder rifles versus the longbow, and you know, back in the day when black powder rifles were first coming around on the scene, the longbow was a lot more accurate and had a lot further range. And, you know, so there's some conversation about, well, how is it that black powder rifles took over on the battlefield when the longbow at the time was a far superior weapon? And the answer lies in human psychology. You have, you know, if I'm just going whoop, 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 and you're going bam, 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 there's a psychological effect that that goes on in the mind of the combatants, where that's a lot more intimidating. It's a lot more. I keep forgetting the actual term that I'm looking for here. But, you know, there's that a lot more intimidating factor when you're talking about black powder. And so that was really the reason that black powder rifles started to take over the battlefield, even though they were not a superior weapon. And so that's that idea of superior firepower. I mean, we understand that on, you know, a very basic level on deep in our animal brains, as you could say.
Oh, yeah. Good observation, actually, because you're absolutely right in what you said there. And as far as the longbow really being more accurate and more effective. And there is a shock factor to, you know, laying down a heavy fire from, you know, guns and so forth. So good stuff there. I, you know, so we've, up to this point, we've really, well, first of all, we defined assault rifle. We've made it clear that AR and AR-15 does not mean assault rifle. And really that an AR-15 is not an assault rifle because it's not fully automatic, which is a big part of it, but it's also not really designed for, I mean, you could argue that there was some design intent for infantry use, but Eugene Stoner was designing a weapon that was intended to be fully automatic. And what we have instead is a civilian version of that is something that is semi-automatic, and thus it's not really suitable for infantry use. In today's modern world, I mean, who are the enemies we're battling with in the Middle East? Well, they're using AK-47s and things like that that are, you know, fully automatic. Well, we're going to go to battle with them with fully automatic weapons. We would be, you know, not as well served going to battle with only a semi-automatic AR-15. So it doesn't fit the purpose or the definition of an infantry rifle in today's, you know, modern warfare.
Yeah, it's that same concept, right? I mean, if I show up and my enemy just has just laying down a ton of firepower and I just can pew, pew, pew from time to time, like there's going to be a psychological toll that takes on me, you know, in the course of the gunfight.
Now, I do feel like we wouldn't be doing our troops justice if I didn't mention that probably most of the time, most troops on the ground are using semi-automatic. Because, and our troops are more effective because they actually are more inclined and they are, it's a fact. They aim their shots better because they're probably taking their time more, and using the sights.
And they're just trained to use the sights on their firearms.
Right. So, you know, just throwing that out there, you know, so yeah, they're using carrying fully automatic weapons, but they're probably only using semi-auto most of the time. But it's good to have that fully auto capability for when they need it. All right.
Absolutely.
So here's myth number three. And this is where we really can get into the weeds if we're not careful, but here we go.
Yeah, serious. Let's be careful.
Regulating AR-15s would reduce mass shootings. Hmm.
It's yeah, that's quite a thing. This is really the reason that we wanted to get into this today is there's a big conversation going on nationally about, you know, would making AR-15s a part of the NFA, the National Firearms Act of the 1930s, would that reduce mass shootings, or would that reduce, I guess, deaths of mass shootings? And Riley actually kind of showed me this this interesting article of some other violent things that went on the same day as Sandy Hook.
Yeah. So I remember the day of Sandy Hook very well. I know exactly where I was. I woke up in the morning, actually, and I slept in that day. So that was kind of interesting. And being in, you know, mountain time, and this, of course, happened in the Eastern time zone, I slept in a little bit. I woke up. And I see this story come in on my phone at one of the alerts, and it's like, you know, shooting at an elementary school. And it, you know, I'm just like, whoa, holy cow. So I remember this very well. Well, I also remember that day very well, too, because the very same day that this horrific thing happened to all these children, and it impacted me substantially because I had a son at the time who was like exactly the same age as these kids. He was 5 or 6 years old. Let's see, 2012. He would have been, 6 years old at the time. And so, you know, boom, I'm just like really impacted by that. But looking at the news that day, there's another story. And this, of course, is in the show notes. But this story took place in China. And what happened there? Well, you had this guy who took a knife, I think a meat cleaver, and went to a elementary school and wounded a whole bunch of kids, 22 kids wounded by a knife. An 85-year-old woman also wounded. Now, nobody died in that instance, and so I'm sure the liberals would be quick to point out, well, because they didn't have assault rifles in China, mm-hmm. that, you know, thus
how it was... How many lives did that save?
Yes, and thus it wasn't as deadly.
Yeah.
But the point here is, would taking away things like AR-15 rifles or any gun for that matter, because in China, do the civilians have guns?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. They have arguably some of the strongest, I mean, probably the strongest gun control in the world. There are many other countries that are probably much the same. I mean, it's a country where individual gun ownership and possession is completely illegal and has been for a long, long time. Would taking away guns entirely here in the U.S., let's just make this argument, would that stop mass killings?
Absolutely not.
At that point, we got to stop using the term mass shooting because then they wouldn't be shooting, so they'd be mass right. killings, which a mass shooting is a mass killing. And you are correct in that it would not stop.
The sad fact of the matter is, and you've said this a lot before too, Riley, you know, you talk about people who are opposed to firearms and stuff like that, talking about, you know, trying to formulate and realize an idyllic society that's not necessarily realistic. But I mean, that's kind of the crux of all of this, right? I mean, yes, if we could like push this magic button that would immediately take away every, you know, just vaporize, turn into thin air, every bullet and every gun, and completely take away the knowledge of how to build a gun, just completely suck it out of humanity and just have like just, you know, this magic button that just got rid of everything totally, completely. It's true that we would have a lot less mass shootings. You know, we would go to a rate of zero shootings, but would that solve the problem, which is the actual problem? And that's, you know, that some folks, they just want to hurt other people for whatever reason. Yep. They just want to go and hurt other people.
Yep. They're just our bad people in this world. I'm not done, by the way. In China that year, this is 2012 in China. In March of that year, a man in Fujian province went on a slashing spree outside of a school, killing 8 and injuring 5. Over the next 2 months, 4 more incidents, leaving 8 primary and kindergarten students dead and 57 injured. Okay, a few months later, a similar incident occurred. 2 months ago, this is as of this article being, this is actually back in December 2012. Okay, so this is referring to, it'd be about October of 2012 then. It says, 2 months ago, 3 students were killed and 13 injured when a man with a machete rampaged through a private daycare center. A daycare. We're talking 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds, right? Or even younger. Just Thursday, this was written on December 15th, 2012. So December 2012, a 25-year-old was arrested who confessed to slashing the faces of a number of victims on Beijing's heavily traveled number 5 and number 10 subway lines. There were dozens of attacks in China that year with knives.
Well, the fact of the matter is that it doesn't really matter where you are. I mean, oftentimes we think, oh, I live in a very safe community and I live in a very safe place and there's not a lot of crime in my area, but, you know, go across town and then you'll have problems. But, you know, a lot of people get kind of lulled into that false sense of security. And I always, whenever I have the choice opportunity to have a student like that in one of my classes, I always ask them, well, have you Googled the sex offender registry in your neighborhood? Because that will change the way that you look at your neighbors.
Good point.
You know, but the fact of the matter is there's a certain percentage of the population that their brains just don't work the same way that yours and mine do.
True.
They don't understand, you know, they have no comprehension of the emotions that we feel, of the connections that we feel, of our humanity. I mean, you know, I always ask in my class, you know, how many of you here define yourselves as human? And of course, everybody raises their hands, right? And it's like, well, what does that mean? Well, Dave Grossman says that we are defined as human by our humanity. And that is, we have this deep, deep seated understanding in our brain that I don't kill my own species, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you see that across mammals in general, right? Where I don't kill my own species. I mean, every once in a while you might see a deer or an elk, you know, gore another deer or an elk or use these antlers, you know, to just totally murder another animal. But as mammals, we have this innate understanding that we don't kill our own species. That's why you don't have a whole lot of 4-year-olds murdering their brand new baby brothers and sisters because they're worried about a lack of resources, right? And so it's important to understand that even though we feel that way, there's a certain percentage of the population that just doesn't get there. Mm-hmm. And their focus and their determination is towards that of dehumanization and destruction, right? Their psychology is dehumanization and destruction based, meaning that it doesn't matter if you're, you know, if you're facing this person. I get a lot of people that say, oh, well, I'll talk my way out of it or something like that. You know, it doesn't matter if you are humanizing yourself. It doesn't matter if you're, oh, well, my wife and my kids and all that kind of stuff. You know, like there is a certain percentage of the population that just doesn't understand that on their very basest of levels in their brains.
Yep.
And those are these sociopaths, these asocial individuals. And so, right. Getting rid of the tool is not going to change the psychology. Getting rid of the tool is not going to change the fact that there are evil people in this world who just want to watch the world burn.
I'm not done.
Keep going. Keep going, man.
One more. 2014. Don't forget, there was a major terrorist attack in Kunming, China. Kunming Railway Station, specifically. 8 knife-wielding men and women attacked. Do you remember how many were killed?
I don't.
29 people killed.
Wow.
And how many injured? 143.
Wow.
Including.
Compare that to Orlando.
Yeah, right? With knives. With knives, people. So.
Yeah, granted, it wasn't committed by, you know, it wasn't a single individual. I can just hear, like. My uncle saying, well, you know, when you're talking about 8 individuals versus 1 individual, like that's kind of, you know, it's like, it's still, I mean, people are able to do massive amounts of damage with no matter what the tool is that they're using to hurt each other.
With knives. And not to say that there still couldn't be attacks using bombs. Do you think just because you outlaw guns that bombs are going to go away? No. And honestly, outlawing guns or even certain types of guns doesn't necessarily mean that the guns themselves are going to go away and not be used in attacks. Yeah. I'm sorry, I got to point it out. It's a big, obvious one to me. the Paris attacks last fall, right?
Absolutely.
They were committed with so-called assault weapons. Actually, they were fully automatic, many of them, leaving so many dead. And this in a country where that type of weapon was very much illegal.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, a lot of people want to talk about how great Australia is. Like, oh, man, Australia, they had one mass shooting and, you know, they had the sense as a nation to get together and pass this common sense gun registration. And, mm-hmm. and eventually, you know, they got all the guns. But I was reading a study the other day that something like more than 40% of all the guns in Australia are still somewhere in Australia that only 30, you know, 30-35% of the people who owned guns at the time actually surrendered them. And then, you know, but there's something more than, you know, even still today, you know, there's yep. more than 40% of the guns that were available before 1996 that are still there. Just people didn't do it, or maybe they passed away. Or, I mean, there could be any one of 100 different reasons, but the fact of the matter is, like you said, you can legislate it all you want, but because there's not a magic button solution, then the only solution remains, the only solution that remains is that we have the responsibility of protecting ourselves, and that yeah. we can, and frankly, here in the United States, we luckily have the right to do that with the use of a firearm.
Speaking of which, there is currently a petition going on at whitehouse.gov that had a signature count goal of 100,000 signatures, and they have actually surpassed that. They have 187,074 signatures on it. So good for you. Bravo. You accomplished your goal. So here's what it says. Guns in America is a complicated issue for many reasons. However, the AR-15 is the weapon of choice for domestic terrorists and others who wish to kill and harm people quickly and efficiently. It serves no other purpose other than to accomplish this. Banning this gun will show that we can act on this issue. It will have symbolic weight while also making one small step forward on dealing with this epidemic. You know
what? That's what we need, is we need some symbolic weight around here.
Yeah, indeed. I think I would argue, Brandon, that what's more quick and efficient than a AR-15 or any firearm for that matter would be a bomb, such as like Oklahoma totally. City or
Boston Marathon.
Right, which was pressure cookers, for crying out loud.
And it was, you know, I mean, they talk about it is the weapon of choice for domestic terrorists. And actually, the domestic terrorists in the case of the Boston Marathon they chose bombs.
Yeah. So they did have some guns too, and had a little bit of shootout with the cops.
Yeah.
But
their main damage was that bomb.
So, you know, and then there's this letter here from Vice President Biden that he shares his thoughts. You know, he says, enough is enough, you know, and all this stuff. That's all grand and well, Vice President Biden. You know what? I think what would be a great deterrent towards these types of attacks is if we were just all walking around carrying our AR-15s.
Totally.
Which I know you're going to talk about that. So I'll save that for later.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so.
Well, and you know, when they go to put together a petition like this, you know, because this kind of leads us into our next point, right? When they go to put together a petition like this, it's like, well, wouldn't it be worth it? Like, you know, yeah, you have this constitutional right, and yeah, you have this hobby that you like, and you have, you know, yeah, that's fine. But like, if we could save one life, wouldn't it be worth getting rid of all the guns out there? I mean, if just one life was saved, isn't human life precious enough? And, you know, that's as one of our, you know, in fact, that's what number four on our list. And so on my Facebook page for Brave Response Shooting, actually this week, we posted a little list, causes of death in 2016 so far. And so far, what tops the list is abortion at 500,000, heart disease at 282,000, cancer at 271,000, tobacco at 160,000, obesity, my problem, at 140,000, medical errors at 115. We go down 60,000s, 30,000s, you know, 20,000s, 10,000 drug abuse, and then, you know, 6,000 for prescription drug overdose, murder by a gun, 5,000 so far in 2016. So just talking about, you know, just medical errors, something that, you know, maybe we could institute some legislation, we could institute some bans on some stuff in the medical business, you know, 115,000 versus 5,000. That's a huge, huge difference there. Mm. And so like to the point here, like, well, if banning AR-15 saved more than one life, would it be worth it? My answer to that, well, having guns like AR-15s in the hands of good law-abiding citizens has saved lives, and isn't that worth it, right? I mean, just these last few weeks, I think on the podcast, there was the one that I joined you for where we talked about that young man who was given what was it? Was an AK-47 mm-hmm. when his dad left town. Do you remember that story?
I sure do.
Yeah. And the, you know, and so he uses an AK-47 to defend his home from attackers and problems. We've talked about, you know, how all these kids and teenagers and stuff over the last, it seems like it's mostly some teenagers that have, you know, used mom and dad's, AR-15 or AK-47 or, you know, similar type of firearm to defend themselves and their brothers and sisters and their homes from, you know, from the attacks of criminals. And so, you know, my answer to that is like, well, geez, not banning AR-15s, having AR-15s in the hands of good law-abiding citizens right now is saving lives right now. Because, you know, the thing that's funny to me, and, you know, Dom Rasso, he talked about this on Fox News a little while ago, where he said, you know, the thing that's kind of funny about this conversation is like, if we're in a situation where we're calling 911 and we are praying to God that the police show up with the exact types of weapons that we are talking about banning, isn't that, I mean, isn't there just some like hypocrisy in that? Like, why wouldn't I, you know, and all respect to law enforcement and police and all that, you know, but still when we're talking about, you know, 8 to 10 minute response times, even down to 3 minute response times, you know, you're just praying for somebody to show up with this type of firearm. Wouldn't it make more sense that I be able to keep that and I be able to have it myself and I be able to learn how to use it to the same level of proficiency as, you know, most police and law enforcement are trained? I mean, as a private citizen, I've got a lot of time that I can go and learn. And there's a lot of instructors in my area that teach awesome AR-15 classes. And so it doesn't take that much to be at the same proficiency level as a lot of police and law enforcement are with these firearms. We can be just as safe. We can be just as effective. We can be just as tactically aware. And you know, it just takes literally maybe a few hours on the range and maybe some YouTube videos at the very, you know, the very smallest barrier to entry of effectiveness. But
don't trust, you know, everything out there on YouTube.
Yeah, you gotta be careful, granted. But yeah, it just stands to reason that instead of, you know, I mean, the popular phrase, when seconds count, the police are minutes away. And so, you know, if I'm wanting police and law enforcement to respond to my situation with these very type of weapons, wouldn't it make sense that it would be more effective for me to acquire and to study and to learn how to use that weapon to be just as effective because I have it there with me and I'm not waiting and, you know, basically asking others to do my job for me.
Yep. Yep. You know, my father-in-law sent me a, you know, a little meme, you know, photo, picture, whatever, recently. And it said, you know, like the average response time for police is, you know, 15 minutes or something, you know, whatever. I don't remember exactly what the time was. Yeah. It was listed there. You know, the average response time of a 357 Magnum, 1,400 feet per second. Sorry.
It's perfect.
What you just said reminded me of that.
Well, I don't know if I've told this story before, but when I lived in Los Angeles, I was dating a girl that was living here in Utah, and it would be pretty frequent for us to meet up in Las Vegas and spend a couple days together there. And, as long distance relationships go. And so she had beaten me to Las Vegas by a couple of hours, and, she had locked her keys in her car.
Oh no.
And, she calls me and she says, "Oh, you know, my keys are locked in my car." And she knows that, you know, we met at a little college town here in Utah. And, you know, here in this little college town, it's very common for the police to call the police and have them come and unlock your car for you. and so she just thinks, oh, well, you know, I'll just call the police and they'll come help me. And, you know, that'll be great. And so she calls into dispatch at the Las Vegas Police Department, and she just says, "Hey, you know, I locked my keys in my car. I'm wondering if you have an officer that can come, you know, help me unlock the car." And the dispatcher straight up just like says, "Ma'am, if you were being raped right now, I would not have an officer to respond to your call," and hangs up. So. Like that in her mind, you know, that in her mind and in my mind, it really solidified, you know, I mean, police and law enforcement, they have a heck of a job and they've got a lot bigger problems than just unlocking, you know, some college kid's car. But then to, you know, when they're dealing with the, especially in Las Vegas with the huge gang issues that they have and all the violence that they have there, you know, I mean, for us to rely on others, you know, I mean, it's definitely the weaker position, especially when we have the right to protect and defend ourselves.
So true about small towns, though, what you said. I just recently I was talking with the town marshal of a small town here in Colorado, and, you know, we were just talking about their department and how they have it all structured, you know, and stuff. And they only have a couple of actual police officers full time. I think there's like a total of four in the whole department. And anyway, the town marshal himself, he's like, yeah, he's like, I always work the Sunday through Wednesday shift. He's like, you know why I work those shifts? I'm like, oh, I don't know. He's like, because I never get any calls. He's like, even the weekend guys don't even get that many calls. But still, he's like, you know, Sunday through Wednesday, quiet time of the week in a little small town. But anyway.
Sit there and play Clash of Clans and he's good to go.
Anyway, cool. So You were talking about the number four myth on our list here, which was if banning AR-15 saved one life, then it would be worth it. And another thing that jumped out to me as you were talking was just the fact that you referenced that young boy, teenage boy, that was able to use, and I think in that case it was actually an AK-47 variant rifle, which, I mean, it doesn't matter to the liberals, right? AK-47, yeah, AR-15, no, you know, same sort of thing. And you know,
SIG MCX.
Yeah, he saved his life potentially using an assault, a so-called quote end quote assault rifle. So I would just turn that right around. Well, if one life is saved by an assault rifle, then it's worth it,
exactly. Right?
You know, so some of these arguments and things that the gun grabbers throw out, you know, at us aren't, you know, they're not really good. You know, they're not true. Logical arguments. So let's make sure that we're clear on that. You brought up some statistics about all the various deaths and what the causes were and so forth. Good stuff there. You know, it is a travesty, by the way. And so I do want to make sure we do justice to, you know, the Orlando shooting, San Bernardino, even this thing last week in Dallas, which just, you know, a horrific thing. Now, that one's kind of interesting too, because there was like a whole bunch of media outlets that were reporting, you know, there was an AK-47, you know, and stuff, or AR-15, they thought maybe it was at one time. And that was because of the guy that they got pictures of walking down the street peacefully protesting with his, you know, openly carried AR-15 slung over his shoulder. You know, so there's all this stuff going out there. And then there was media reports, it was an SKS. And actually, I have to say, a lot of the pro-gun media sites were reporting it was an SKS. And, you know, so of course these horrible things could be done even with a non-traditional, you know, so-called assault rifle like an AK-47 or AK-74 or AR-15. And you know what? Those reports were flat out wrong, because I saw the images of the dead terrorist after they blew him up and his rifle sitting right there. And you know what? It was an AK-74. And you know what? So I'm always going to call out, you know, people when they're wrong. I'm always going to fight for and argue for the truth. And the truth in this case is he was using, as the gun grabbers would call it, a true, you know, a assault rifle, which is not necessarily the case.
A weapon of war.
A weapon of war, right? And so, That may be. But you know what? He could have done a lot of what he had done with a bolt action rifle. He was primarily, absolutely, you know, hiding about, you know, hiding up in a parking garage, looking down on these officers, sniping them, right? And, you know, honestly, it probably would have been more effective if he had been using a .30-06 as far as, like, inflicting, you know, more effective kills, I guess. And I hate to say it that way. And that was just a horrible travesty, okay? So we have these horrible things that have occurred, and I recognize that fact. And yes, in many cases, they were using semi-automatic, you know, rifles, carbines. That's what I call them. They're carbine rifles. I am a certified, Colorado Post certified patrol rifle or carbine rifle instructor. I'm very familiar with this platform as far as how it's used, how to effectively use it, and its capabilities as far as it being a fighting tool, what it can actually do. And the AR-15 is a powerful weapon, but there are certainly other things that are much more powerful and more effective. And there are also many things that are arguably less effective as far as their firepower. The reality is, however, the same weekend that all these protests and things were going on in Dallas and elsewhere across the country, right there in Chicago, our little, you know, gun control capital of the U.S., or at least for I don't know if Hawaii has some pretty strict laws.
Yeah, I would say
California just passed some really ridiculous laws.
Yeah.
You know, but Chicago is a pretty strict place as far as guns go, and in just the one weekend. I heard it reported a number of times, and I don't have it here in front of me, but it's not unusual to see over a weekend 40, 50, 60, 70 people shot in, you know, in inner city Chicago, basically. And 95%+ of those murders are committed with handguns.
Yeah.
So, and of course, many of the same people arguing for the banning of AR-15 rifles would also be on, you know, the same side of banning semi-automatic handguns, and in many of them just banning guns altogether. But we've already covered how effective that's going to be as far as stopping murders and killings from taking place. It's not going to. It won't. There are still murders and killings that occur in Australia, even after the gun control laws that they passed. We talked about that in a past
Absolutely.
Episode. You talked about, touched on a little bit again today. We talked about the knife problems, the sword problems, the machete problems in China. We've talked about attacks in Paris and other places of the world where illegal guns are still somehow acquired and then used in major attacks. There was just this attack in this last week or two ago, what was it, Malaysia or somewhere, you know, tons of people killed. I'm sure many of the guns used in those instances are also illegal. So the point is, just because we ban these weapons does not mean it'll fix the problem. Let's talk about...
It absolutely will not.
Yeah. Yeah,
you're right.
Let's talk about another major argument of the gun grabbers, and that is because I think it's closely related to the AR-15 or modern sporting rifles. And that is the topic of high-capacity magazines. Now, we could dedicate a whole other entire episode to this one topic because there's a whole slew of arguments we could make for the case and also share the gun grabber's case against high-capacity magazines. But what is the myth surrounding high-capacity magazines? Well, we had the Aurora Theater shooting a couple years ago, and that obviously was a big time media event. One of the things that was talked about over and over and over again was how the gun that was used, or at least one of the guns, it was the gun that most people focused on, and that was an AR-15 type rifle. And this is actually used in President or Vice President Biden's letter on that petition page where he says right here, he said the lone gunman walked into the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. He carried a Smith & Wesson M&P-15, a variation of the AR-15 rifle modified to hold as many as 100 bullets. It was modified to hold 100.
Modified.
Really, what it was is he had a 100-round magazine that, by the way, jammed within like the first couple of shots that he fired.
Yeah.
And so, what did he have to do? He had to throw that gun down. And most of the casualties inflicted within the Century 21 Theater in Aurora, Colorado, were inflicted with a simple pump action shotgun with probably, actually, I know what they were. He was using a double-aught buckshot, okay? And then also a handgun.
Yeah. Same thing here in Utah with the Trolley Square shooting in Suleiman Tulovic.
Yep.
14, 16, something like that, just because he learned how to load a shotgun.
Yep. Honestly, at particularly closer ranges, which most of these incidents, Sandy Hook, Aurora, Orlando, you know, these are places, you know, the focus has been these AR-15 rifles or similar, and they're in close quarters. A shotgun is a more powerful weapon in close quarters with the right loads.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And a simple pump action shotgun, which isn't even semi-automatic, it can be extremely devastating. Okay. Now, I'm sure that there are people that would have us outlaw those as well. Okay, whatever. But the point is, you know, the reason why we're talking about here is these high capacity magazines, and that if we ban those, it's going to fix all these problems as well. No,
right. Well, that's the idea is less bullets equals less death.
Right.
Right. That's kind of the idea behind this. And is that necessarily the case? Like, I know, you know, Riley, before I drove out to Colorado last week, I called you to get kind of some information on the magazine capacity bans that were in effect in Colorado. And Riley was really nice to, you know, share with me what he thought was safe. And I, you know, wanted to make sure that I left things at home that weren't going to be legal in Colorado. But the whole idea, and looking back at some of the press conferences and stuff, when that legislation was being enacted, you know, the biggest thing that they were talking about is, you know, how this reload, you know, well, if you restrict magazines to maybe 10 capacity instead of 30, like on a standard AR-15 magazine, then, you know, that could be potentially, you know, 20 people that their lives are preserved because, you know, it takes so long for the guy to reload and so long for this to happen. And it just shows just a total lack of understanding in how this actually works.
Yeah. So, to that point, or, you know, to this whole issue with magazine capacity and, you know, all right, where do we draw the line at? You know, do we draw a line at 30 rounds, 20 rounds, 15 rounds, which, by the way, in Colorado, it's, you know, greater than 15 round capacity, 10 rounds, 7 rounds, like New York tried to do, or I guess they kind of did, but like, anyway, that's a weird deal.
It didn't really matter anyway, because you're not supposed to have a gun there anyway.
You know, and where do you draw the line at? Well, I want to play some audio. And this audio actually covers a lot of really awesome points. It hits the magazine thing really well, but a whole other slew of things too. This is audio from Dr. Susanna Hupp, who is a former doctor. I assume she's probably still licensed as a doctor. I don't think she practices anymore. She's a former representative to the House in Texas. But she is also very well known because she was a survivor of the 1991 Killeen, Texas Luby's cafeteria shooting massacre. And this was a pretty big deal, right? You had a guy who went into this this restaurant. He shot 50 people and killed, I think, 23 total, including Dr. Susanna Hupp's parents. And it's a heartbreaking story to listen to her entire testimony when she talks about her father, you know, trying to rush the gunman, and he gets shot, and, you know, and he's lying there dying. You know, she tries to tell her mother, hey, let's get out of here, Mom. There's a way to escape this direction. Let's go. And she turns around and runs, and she gets out. And that's probably why she survives. She thinks her mom's following her and turns around later and realizes she didn't. And her mom's executed right there, you know, cradling her husband in her lap. As he dies, you know, just heartrending, horrific. I think one of the guns that was used in that was a Glock pistol. Of course, we know what the gun grabbers would have us also do about Glock pistols. But, you know, I'm getting a little bit tired of listening to people criticize certain types of guns, certain types of ammo, certain types of magazines, and even certain types of people, including police officers and so forth, when they themselves haven't been in some of the situations that they are criticizing. And so listen to this audio of a congressional testimony of Dr. Susanna Hupp as she tells this committee comprised of, I think it was it the Senate or the House? I think it's the House. She's testifying in front of the House of Representatives, the U.S. House of Representatives. This is powerful testimony. All right, so it's we're going to play about two and a half minutes worth of audio here. We hope that you enjoy. Stand by. I'm going to get this rolling.
Let me make sure that you understand I'm not here representing the NRA. I'm not even a member. Okay? Secondly, I'd like to say that in your opening statements, you commented specifically on my testimony saying that basically it had nothing to do with this issue. And I had to chuckle because then I noticed you had Mr. Brady up here who was hit not with an assault weapon but with a .22 caliber revolver. So getting beyond that, I didn't grow up in a house with guns. I don't hunt. I personally abhor hunting. But I was given a gun by a friend when I was 21 to carry in my purse for self-defense, and I was taught how to use it. A couple of years ago, my parents and I went to a cafeteria in Texas on a bright sunny day. We weren't in a dark alley where we weren't supposed to be. And as you all know the story, this madman drove his truck through the window, and he began shooting. Well, immediately, my father and I got down on the floor and put the table up in front of us. And this guy kept shooting. And you're thinking, what could it be? Is it a robbery? That's the first thing that generally comes to mind. And he keeps shooting. It took me a good 45 seconds to realize that this man wasn't there to commit a robbery. He wasn't there for a hit. He was there to simply shoot as many people as he possibly could. Now, I'd like to make something clear. I hear all this talk about how many bullets can go in a clip. I've been there. I can tell you it doesn't matter. It takes 1 second to switch out a clip. You can have one bullet or 100 bullets. It doesn't matter, guys. I've been there. He goes, dump, dump, just like that. That's not enough time to rush a man. I promise you. When I finally realized what was occurring, I thought, I got him. And I reached for my purse. He was maybe 12 feet away. You know, is it possible my gun could have jammed? Sure. Is it possible I could have missed? Sure. But I can tell you I've hit much smaller targets at much greater distances. But then I realized that a couple of months earlier I had made the stupidest decision of my life. I took my gun out of my purse and left it in my car. Because as you well know, in the state of Texas, it's sometimes a felony offense to carry a gun in your purse. Just one final statement. I've been sitting here getting more and more fed up with all of this talk about these pieces of machinery having no legitimate sporting purpose, no legitimate hunting purpose. People, that is not the point of the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is not about duck hunting. And I know I'm not going to make very many friends saying this, but it's about our right, all of our right, to be able to protect ourselves from all of you guys up there.
It's pretty powerful.
There you go. Yeah, it really is. Like I said, I'm tired of hearing people, you know, voice their opinions. I mean, it's their right to do so. And certainly I voice my fair share of opinions. But I'm tired of hearing all this criticism of guns and magazines and ammunition and self-defense and concealed carry and just the overall, you know, right to keep and bear arms, which is a Second Amendment, you know, right. I'm tired of hearing all these criticisms by people that don't even know what the heck they're talking about. And here is a woman that knows what she was talking about because she was there, she lived it, She breathed it. She miraculously survived it. And here just gives one of the most powerful testimonies that I've ever heard in support for the Second Amendment. And it's like she said there at the end, and I'm going to come back to this here as we close the up the podcast here in just a few minutes, about how it's not about hunting, it's not about ducks, it's about our right to defend ourselves and in fact, maybe even defend ourselves from all of you up there. And by you, she was pointing at and referring to the committee of congressmen.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Brandon.
That brings us perfectly into our final myth. And that is that AR-15 is not a good tool for self-defense. One of the common things that we hear a lot is, you know, well, why would you need an AR-15 when, you know, old Joe Biden, he talks about how all you need is a double-barreled shotgun and you can just stand out on your front porch and shoot it into the air randomly. and that'll scare off any attackers. Why would you ever need an AR-15? And there's a couple different ways that you can approach this. There's the less effective way, which, you know, you talk about, well, all the hobbies and everything that's associated around the AR-15. And, you know, it's like, well, that's a dumb hobby. Why don't we just get rid of it? It's like, well, world championships of baby crying is also a dumb hobby. Why don't we get rid of that? It's because we have a right. We have the right to enjoy our hobbies. But more importantly, you know, I would say to somebody, you know, have you ever been confronted with multiple attackers? You know, in a podcast a little while back, we talked about how these days criminals are tending to be more dangerous in that 9 times out of 10, they're under the influence of some type of narcotic, which would mean that you would need more firepower in order to stop them, in order to shut down their body from continuing to do whatever it is that they're doing that's threatening your life or the lives of those you love. 9 times out of 10, these guys are committing crimes with friends or accomplices. This is from the FBI. And then also the third thing that the third trend that we're starting to see among criminals is that they're heavily armed. And for all three of those instances, the AR-15 is the perfect home defense tool. If you're dealing with somebody who's under the influence of narcotics, in order to stop that person, which again, go back and listen to what was it, episode maybe 10, I think that we talked about magazine capacity, but if you're dealing with somebody who's under the influence of narcotics, you're going to need multiple rounds in order to stop that individual, multiple rounds with good targeting in order to stop that individual. If you're talking about multiple targets heavily armed, then it's possible your your double-barreled shotgun just may not be enough firepower to stop all of those individuals, especially if they're pretty set on harming you and the ones that you love.
Yeah.
And then going back to, Dom Rasso's point that I mentioned earlier, in the end, you know, if I'm calling guys, if I'm calling 911 and I'm praying that police and law enforcement show up with the very tool that we're talking about here, doesn't it stand to reason that it would be more effective for me and I could take more of the responsibility for my own protection into my hands if I were to purchase and train with an AR-15 and learn to do it myself?
Yeah. So I was thinking to what you were saying, the AR-15 with the 223 caliber round with a decent capacity magazine, it is a very excellent home defense weapon. As I mentioned, I'm an instructor. I'm very familiar with the weapon and what it can do and its benefits. You know, the ideal situation when you find yourself threatened is not that you have a handgun on you. It's not that you have a knife or pepper spray or anything like that, or a taser. If your life is endangered, you know what I would want to have in my hand would be something like an AR-15.
Absolutely.
Because it is, now certainly there are things like we've talked about earlier that are more powerful. And I certainly understand the benefits of a shotgun for a home defense type weapon. You know what? I have both. I've got the shotgun. I've got the AR. I've got my, you know, 9mm Glock. I think having all those options is a good idea. But as we talked about before, some of the news stories we've shared in the past, the young boy that, you know, stopped a home invasion using a carbine rifle. There was the mother in Detroit that stopped a home invasion using a carbine rifle. In that case, it was the 9mm High Point. Still, I mean, and of course, the media would look at that. The gun grabbers would look at that and go, that's an assault rifle. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but it doesn't matter. And so, you know, but they can be and are extremely effective home defense weapons. So I'm not about to sling mine around my back and go walking down the street, although more and more I'm starting to think about doing that. But certainly in my home fortress, this is my home fortress. I'm sitting here right now in my office, an arm's length away. I have a carbine rifle available to me if I needed it. And you know what? It is the choice. It is what I would go to if my home was to get broken into right now with my wife and kids playing upstairs right above me, hopefully being pretty quiet, which I think they're doing a pretty good job. So that is my weapon of choice. If you've got a handgun and you've got a carbine rifle nearby, you're going to only hopefully use that handgun for as long as you need to fight your way to that rifle, because it is going to be the more effective weapon for self-defense. You know, I talk about this in my classes. I get, you know, people that come through class and they'll say, you know, I'm not interested in these Glocks and these other semi-automatics. I'm going to carry my trusty 38 Special, you know, Smith & Wesson five-shot, you know, revolver for self-defense. And I look at them and I'm like, you know what? That is okay. That is fine. I love a good revolver as much as the next guy does. But you know what? It is not my first choice for self-defense. And the reason why is because five shots out of a little revolver, in my opinion, I'm not comfortable with that for surviving a brutal attack on myself or my family. I'm just not. Because you know how long it takes for a person to go through five shots in a life or death scenario, in a, you know, deadly force encounter. That's what I was looking for.
Deadly force encounter. Yeah.
How long would it take you to go blast your way through five shots in a five-shot revolver, Brandon?
Just, I mean, a blink.
2 seconds?
Very quickly.
2 seconds.
Yeah, maybe 2 seconds.
How, even if you took somebody's heart out with all five shots, how long do you think they could continue being a threat to you?
Medical tech, you know, the standard thing that we're hearing from emergency rooms these days is that you can survive up to 3 minutes without any oxygen being delivered to your brain.
So it's plausible that I could shoot all five shots into a bad guy's chest, and for 3 minutes, he could still potentially pose a threat to me.
Yep.
Now that's...
Which the average gunfight lasts, what, less than 20 seconds?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not... I'm not saying it's common or even expected that I'm going to do that and the guy's going to continue shooting at me for 3 minutes. But that just gives... It gives us a little bit of perspective as far as I'm just not comfortable with only five shots. And I'm just not that good at reloading my revolver that fast. I'm just not. I could practice. I'd love to get as good as Jerry Michalik. But you know what? I'm already pretty darn fast and pretty darn good with my Glock 19 or Glock 17, both of which have 15 and 17 round capacities respectively. And I can reload one of those, well, as Dr. Susanna Hupp put it, bam, bam.
Bam, bam.
Right? One in, one out. And so, you know, that, so then if it comes down to it, and we're talking home defense here, that handgun's fine, but even better is that carbine rifle. I'm going to switch a little bit as far as perspective goes. And last week for the 4th of July edition of the podcast, Brandon, I assume you listened since you weren't with us.
I have listened.
What did you think of that episode?
Oh, so awesome. It was so good. If you haven't listened to, like, one of my big weaknesses is just a general understanding of history. I was one of those punk kids back in history class that thought I was way too cool for school. And so a knowledge, a working knowledge of history, especially, to the level that you and Jacob both have it. I'm super jealous of that. It was amazing and informative and entertaining. I mean, just the incredible stories of the incredible men and women that kicked this whole thing off. It was incredible. Right. I loved it.
So a couple questions for you, since I know you listened and you learned your history because of it, I guess. 1775, 1776, what was the so-called quote-unquote assault rifle of choice at that time?
It was the flintlock.
Right. So right. You had a hammer with a spring that drove the hammer forward with a piece of flint attached. And what would that flint do? Well, it would strike a piece of metal, and that flint would scrape little, small, basically microscopic flakes and pieces of metal, and it'd cause it to kind of almost ignite. It would spark, right? That spark would be driven down into a flash pan, the flash pan igniting with a little trail of powder going down into the very bottom end of that barrel where another load of powder sat, igniting and pushing a musket ball through a non-rifled barrel, right?
Yep, smooth barrel.
And typically probably on the order of about 70 caliber, give or take. There was a few variations and things. And, pretty good sized chunk of lead would come out of that, but not terribly accurate, not terribly long range, not really all that effective. I mean, it was effective once it hit its intended target for the most part, but it's not often we hit the intended target. But anyway, that was the weapon of choice. That was the modern rifle at that time. Was the flintlock
military
muzzle loader.
The definition of the military.
Yeah, rifle. You had the...
Because that's what everybody in the military
had. You had the Brits using that sort of weapon, and you had the Americans using that sort of weapon. And we talked about how these patriots, when the Brits marched off to, where they had the battle at Lexington, and then they went on to Concord, and they were trying to take, these huge hordes of powder so they could kind of get control over the guns in the Northeast. On their way back, they kind of failed at that, and on their way back, all these patriots are like picking them off, And I love that aspect of the history. And my point is, that you go back and listen to the episode and you'll get a sense for why the Second Amendment exists the way it does today, and how, yes, it mentions this concept of a militia, but that concept of militia was not what the gun grabbers today would have you believe it is. And so the people themselves, individually and as a body, were armed. But mostly it was individual efforts that were combined, to make something greater than they were. And they were able to successfully fight off the Brits and fight for their independence. And here we live in this great country as we do today. All right. So switching to today, I still believe in a militia, people, but I don't necessarily, I'm not banded up with one of these, militias at the Bundy Ranch or anything like that. Okay. I just believe
you're not down there throwing the N-word around.
I just believe, Brandon, that if you or if our country were to come under attack, and if you or I or Jacob or anybody else that we know and are familiar with and that we know believes similarly, that if our country came under attack and we had to, we would pick up our arms and we would fight. And to me, that is, that's our militia right there, is the fact that we have a certain individuality to the people in this country, a sense of responsibility, a sense of self-worth, a sense of accountability. There we go. A sense of accountability that we would stand up for our own rights and our own people, our own homes, our lands, our businesses. And we would stand up and we would fight. And we should all at any time be ready and capable and able to do that. And we cannot do that if we disarm the people effectively. So that, to me, that's the greatest travesty to getting rid of and outlawing or controlling in some way these modern semi-automatic sporting arms, these AR-15s and so forth, because it limits and reduces our capability as a people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, to me, the basic idea here is government should fear the people, not people fearing the government.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways that government subjugates its people is by disarming them and making sure that it's the only one that has arms. Now, if our government is successful in disarming us and making sure that the armaments that we're able to have and keep as good law-abiding citizens in our homes and for fun and for everything else that we have and keep firearms for, then they will be successful in making in essentially the arms race for fear, right? Then the power of the people is lost. The power of the government increases exponentially.
Yeah. It's clear that, particularly after you listen to the little bit of a history lesson we covered in our episode last week on the 4th of July, what the intent and the idea was behind our founders' Second Amendment, and why it was put in there and the way it was done. And so I do want to close this up. Here is a quote from George Washington. "A free people ought not only be armed and disciplined, but they should have sufficient arms and ammunition to maintain a status of independence from any who might attempt to abuse them, which would include their own government."
Drop the mic.
That's kind of my thought, exactly. Like, if my mic wasn't attached to the mic stand and the shock mount here, I would just drop it. Boom.
Just drop it.
So, good stuff, Brandon. Thanks for spending your time with me today talking about the myths, some of the myths. I don't even think we've covered everything we could have covered, but...
Oh, no.
But some of the myths...
We haven't scratched the surface, but...
Yeah. Some of the myths surrounding assault rifles. There you go. So, today's episode is sponsored by something we've never featured on the podcast before. It is the Taft Precision AR-15 Polished Mil-Spec Lower Parts Kit. And Brandon, I'm going to let you talk about it just briefly.
That's right. The Taft Precision Lower Parts Kit. I have actually built maybe 5 or 6 rifles to this point using primarily the Taft Precision Lower Parts Kit on all of those builds. And the thing that I like about it, number one, I have never once had a part out of spec. And according to what they say online, if you do have a part out of spec, like if I were to have one of those, I could just get a brand new one for free, that was in spec. But that was one of the big reasons that I bought them at first is number one, it was really competitively priced. And then, my first two, both of them were just perfectly in spec and they looked to be, they had nice finishes and they were high quality. But what surprised me was the polishing on the sear surfaces of the trigger and hammer. They're precision ground and polished. And so for a mil-spec lower parts kit, the trigger pull was just, it's been very consistent across the, 5 or 6 rifles that I've built using the kit. But then also it's just been a very crisp, just a great mil-spec trigger. Like, you could spend, $200-$250. You could spend, upwards of $300 on just a trigger, not talking about all the pins and springs and stuff that go into the lower receiver. But the Taft Precision Kit comes with everything that you need, and the trigger is very high quality, and all of the parts and pieces have lasted really well and held up really well in all of my AR-15 builds. And so they're actually on the USA Firearm Training store. You can go in there, and I believe it's the only lower parts kit that's featured in the store, which makes it easy to find.
It is. It's on sale right now.
For your next
it's on sale right now for $49,
$49.99. That is a steal.
Originally priced.
Anybody that knows about LP kits.
Right. It's normally priced at $55. So because you heard about it here, folks, on the Concealed Carry podcast, for right now it's available for $49.99.
Awesome.
So, and we've got quite a few in stock, I believe, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It looks like a little over 100.
Yep, so check it out there. Thank you, Brandon, for giving us some of the background and details on the TAF Precision AR-15 mil-spec lower parts kit. So, also, we always do our picks of the week. And you know what? I should have just made that my pick of the week. Cop out. instead, you know, I'm going to go first here, and I will throw out another pick. My pick this week is kind of unusual. I've never done a product quite like this before, and this is the Smith's 4-inch fine and coarse diamond combo sharpening stone. It's not terribly expensive. It's not terribly fancy. It's very simple. There are certainly nicer sharpening products and kits out there, but this, I've got like three of these. I always have one within arm's reach, and so these are the ones I use the most. It's like, my knife's getting a little dull, and just a quick little, a couple strokes across the, usually just the fine side on this Smith's sharpening stone, and, that's all it needs. And it's actually not a stone, just so that it's clear, it's a diamond sharpener. So it's got the little diamond dust grit, whatever stuff. So there you go. Check it out. There's a link in the show notes. I think it just takes you to Amazon. But Smith's 4-inch fine and coarse diamond combo sharpening stone. Brandon, what's your pick this week?
To comment on that, there's nothing that just... I few times where I feel more contented than when I have just a brand new, freshly sharpened blade.
Oh, yes.
That's awesome. my pick of the week, I kind of teased it at the beginning. I mentioned that for the last 2 weeks, at least, I've been carrying an AR-15 with me everywhere I go. And the reason that you haven't seen me on the news is because I don't open carry it. I built a little AR pistol in 300 Blackout. And so instead of having a standard stock on the back, it has a little pistol rod or pistol tube and no actual stock on the back. And so I could fit that AR pistol in my EVAC takedown carbine sling pack by Hazard 4. So the Hazard 4 EVAC takedown carbine sling pack is my pick of the week, and we'll have a little link to the one that I bought in the show notes. But what's cool about this is I can take my AR pistol, or now since my tax stamp has come back, it's now an SBR, and I can put that in this little pack, or if you have a full-size AR, you can take it down. And then, you can fit both halves in there, and it's really simple to just, take it out, put it back, put it together, and it's good to go. But just kind of as a social experiment, I've been carrying this thing. What happened was, as I was coming home, maybe 3 weeks ago, I was carrying, a brand new AR-15 that I had built up into my apartment where I live. And there were some kids playing on the grass, and they were a little bit nervous. They're like, "Oh, gun." It's like, "It's okay, guys. This is my job." Like, I just tried to make him feel a little comfortable about it. But I was thinking geez, I've got to be more careful with this. And so, I bought one of these bags, and I've been carrying an AR-15 with me everywhere I go. I carry it when I go into the gas station to pick up a drink. I carry it to the grocery store. I have been carrying around an AR-15 with me for pretty much nonstop the last 2 weeks, and this Hazard 4 EVAC takedown carbine sling pack has made it possible. Kind of fun.
You're crazy, dude. Plus, you live in Utah.
That's true.
The wild, wild west.
We are the wild west out here.
I mentioned last week, my pick, I think last week was the Kel-Tec Sub 2000 9mm carbine, which, you pull on the trigger guard and that sucker just folds in half. And that thing, it fits in my backpack like easy. Like I just drop it in there, I could have my laptop and my rifle. Boom. Mic drop
all in
again.
One spot. Okay. How would that be?
Yep. All right. And then coming up next, Brandon, what's up next for you, bud?
Well, what's next for me? I can't really talk about it. It's classified. But I am headed to Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Japan to look at and meet with some electronics manufacturers for an awesome product that we're working on here that I can't mention one word about other than this. And so we're going to go out and find a super high quality manufacturer out there that can kind of stick to our extremely rigorous standards and hopefully make this thing a reality in a year or year and a half.
Interesting. Yeah, and you said electronic, so there's your hint, folks. And I would guess you would look here in the States, but there's not that many electronics manufacturers that probably fit the niche that you're looking to fulfill, is there?
Nobody in the States can build it for the price that we need it. Yeah, unfortunately. Like with the Brave Response holster, of course, all of that is all manufactured. We source all of our materials from suppliers here in the United States, and it's 100% handmade here in the United States, here in Utah, which we take a lot of pride in. But for some things, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the United States is becoming less of a manufacturing country and more of an idea, you know, more of a knowledge worker kind of a country. And so, I'm excited. I've never been to the Orient. I'm 6'5", I'm 340 pounds, and I'm excited to take pictures with everybody that I see and see how many people I can like talk them into letting me pick them up for pictures and just like go and be just a classic standard redneck American abroad. So it's going to be fun.
But you're not going to be taking your AR pistol with you, though, are you?
You know, I imagine that the TSA would probably find that before it was any of use.
Right on. Cool. Have a good trip. Of course, that's not next week or anything like that, but that's...
No, that'll be the middle of August. I'm doing that.
Cool. I am, for my up next, this week, I am covering for Jacob. So, as you've noticed, Jacob was not on the podcast with us this week. He is on vacation enjoying time with his family, which is oh so important and probably oh so deserved. And so I am trying to hold down the fort here with everything going on at USA Firearm Training. Good times, good fun. And so with that, we are going to wrap up this week's episode of the Concealed Carry Podcast. As always, we like to encourage you to subscribe to the podcast. If you haven't done so already, go check it out. Subscribe. Subscribing is the best way to always have immediate access to the podcast. So if you need help with that, you can always find every episode on our main webpage. Like if you're looking at the podcast episodes in the website, there is always a little help there. Like if you click on the subscribe link, it'll take you to a page where you'll see tutorial videos to help you know how to do that. So, and then also we've been sharing reviews that people have been kind enough to leave us lately. And this week I've got a new one I wanted to share just real quick. And this is from his username is on iTunes is Always Planning. Cool. Glad to hear that. And the title is Officially Addicted. Awesome. And so that was awesome part was me. But he says, Officially Addicted. It's hard to listen to these episodes and not love what they are sharing. Seriously, top-notch work from Riley and Jacob and Brandon. Actually, I added that
sometimes.
In. He says, and all their guests. Okay, so he did include you too. Riley and Jacob and all their guests.
Thank you.
I was literally refreshing my podcast feed all day today waiting for the new episode to be released. Hats off to y'all, and thanks for producing content I look forward to listening to. Of all the many podcasts I listen to, this is the only one I am always caught up on.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's high praise.
Yeah, no.
We're sweet.
Very excited to hear that. Thank you, Always Planning. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the feedback. Thanks for letting us know how you feel. It really pumps us up. If you need to get in touch with us, you want to leave feedback, other than leaving a review on iTunes, which we always appreciate, and you may have a chance of being shared here on the podcast. But if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so by going to usafirearmtraining.com/contact, and you can also send us messages through Facebook. So there you go. With that, Brandon, we're going to say goodbye to the folks. Any last words from you?
Goodbye, everyone. Thanks for having me, Riley.
Thanks for joining me. Appreciate your time. It's been fun. And so, everyone, we will see you next week for the news edition. It'll be on Monday, the news edition episode of the podcast. Thanks so much. Take care. See you later.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. USA Firearm Training and the Concealed Carry Podcast strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in the podcast.